From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how Saddam Hussein has managed to stay in power in spite of the Gulf War, subsequent coup attempts, and continued Allied bombing. We talk with Patrick Coburn, senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent and co-author of the new book Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. Coburn was last in Iraq during the December bombings. And we meet soul singer Otis Clay. His latest CD reunites him with producer Willie Mitchell and several of the session musicians from the Memphis soul label High Records. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Saddam Hussein is still in power. In spite of the Gulf War, subsequent coup attempts, U.S. spies serving on U.N. weapons inspection teams, and continued Allied bombings, including three raids yesterday. Patrick and Alexander Coburn investigate how Saddam has managed to survive in their new book, Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. Today, the New York Times reports that a forthcoming book by a former U.N. weapons inspector claims that the CIA had spies working on U.N. weapons inspection teams earlier than had previously been reported, and those agents may have been connected to a failed coup attempt in 1996. The Coburns say that their understanding is that the involvement of these agents in the planning of the coup, if any, was minimal. My guest, Patrick Coburn, is senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, a position he formerly held at the Financial Times. He remained in Baghdad during the Gulf War and was last there during the December Allied bombings. I spoke with him Thursday, shortly before he returned to his base in Jerusalem. He told me that he's pessimistic that bombing Iraq will end Saddam Hussein's regime.
Well, the biggest bombing of Iraq was in 1991. And we all know that that wholly failed to end the regime. The bombing we saw last December, I was in Baghdad, was much smaller on scale than, in scale than we saw then. So it's very unlikely that this will end the regime. The Iraqis are quite used to being bombed. You see on television big ministerial buildings being hit, but usually they're empty, they've been evacuated. It really doesn't hit the heart of the regime. And even during 91, I was told by when it was very heavy bombing over a long period, I was told by the head of Iraqi military intelligence, who's now in exile, that they lost no officer over the rank of a brigadier.
Well, you point out in your book that the infrastructure that supports Saddam Hussein's regime is the people, not the buildings. Saddam Hussein has managed to stay hidden during all of the bombing last year and in previous years. How does Saddam Hussein stay hidden? What do you know about his secret whereabouts?
That's a good question. I mean, during the original bombing and I think during the last one too, one place, I mean, a senior Iraqi officer told me that they weren't was inside a deep bunker, because they thought that the Allies, the U.S., Britain, knew where these bunkers were. What he normally does is stay very mobile. He stays in suburban houses. He shifts his address very often. He doesn't tell anybody where he is. He moves around Baghdad in an old car with one bodyguard, although there are other bodyguards further out, but he doesn't want to identify who or where he is by a great big convoy with lots of armed men around. And if any other senior official wants to get in touch with him, you can't ring him up direct. You ring up his office, and then you get rung back from another location. Or sometimes he just turns up in person. So the number of people who know where he is in Baghdad at any one time is very limited.
Do you think he uses disguises when he's going from one place to another?
He has doubles to confuse the issue. People who look like him, people who've been trained to behave like him. But it's more, the disguise is more the vehicles he uses, the place he stays. He doesn't alter his appearance. And I met one Iraqi recently who was just driving through the traffic a couple of years ago. He looked up, and in the car beside him, there was Saddam Hussein driving himself. That doesn't mean he's isolated. There are bodyguards there, but there aren't a bunch of people in uniform which make his position identifiable.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Patrick Coburn. He's senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, co-author of the new book, Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. There have been several attempts to overthrow Saddam Hussein. The CIA has been involved in a couple of them. What do you consider to be the largest, most ambitious attempt that the CIA was involved with?
It was in 1996. They had a very carefully organized attempt based in Jordan. They believed that they'd won over senior Iraqi officers right at the heart of Saddam's power. in his personal security, in his communications units. They were very confident. The opposition group they were backing, the Iraqi National Accord, was even giving interviews publicly saying that they were going to overthrow Saddam and do so quickly. Unfortunately, it seems that from the very beginning, this operation had been penetrated by Iraqi intelligence, that the Jordanian prime minister of the day, who was very much opposed to the regime in Iraq, told us that he thought that the Iraqis could always see them coming, that every move that was made by the opposition based in Jordan seemed to be known in Baghdad first. And they knew it because they'd intercepted the communications between Amman and Baghdad. And finally, they struck in the middle of 1996, and there were mass arrests, mass torturing, and mass executions. There are still people being executed. If you would see the lists of people who've been executed in Baghdad recently, there are still people being executed in over the last few months who are involved in this attempt.
What was the plan to overthrow Saddam?
It was to make a coup from the center. It's a regime which has focused power, particularly since the Gulf War, on around the person of Saddam, but is very dependent on the inner presidential security, the special Republican Guard units, the inner family. They thought if they could strike right at the center, then they could begin a military coup, and then the whole regime would begin to disintegrate. It was very much aimed at the top of the regime, and they felt that they had got the right officers in critical positions who would support them. Unfortunately, as I said, the Iraqis knew this from quite an early stage and knew every move that particularly the CIA station in Amman was making. And much to their astonishment, they suddenly saw this all disintegrate and all their people arrested.
What was the CIA's role in this coup? Was it just funding this opposition group, or was it actively helping to plan the coup? Was it leading the planning of it?
Yes. I mean, this was very much a hands-on operation and was in... were allied to other intelligence services, including the British. They had meetings with... they were closely associated with Jordanian intelligence, with Saudi intelligence. It was trying to pool resources to identify who in the inner elite in Baghdad they might be able to suborn to get to support them.
How do you as a journalist get, without betraying any sources, how do you as a journalist get information about a secret CIA coup attempt?
Well, after you have a disaster like this, there are casualties who survive. So there are people, Iraqis who are involved in it, who did manage to get out of the country, who one can talk to, who are well informed on what happened. Secondly, there are other opposition groups who knew about it but weren't closely associated with it, who have very precise information about what was going on. So it would be much more difficult to find out details of a successful plot. But when something goes seriously wrong, it's much easier to find people who will talk. Even so, it's not that easy, but we were able to find people.
Why is it easier to find out the people behind an unsuccessful coup?
Oh, because people have fled into exile. There are people whose relatives have been killed, people who are very angry, and people who want to blame others on over what happened. They have they, in some cases, they think would have been organized in a slightly different way, it might have been successful. And some people are very bitter because their relatives have been arrested, tortured savagely, sometimes executed, sometimes have just disappeared.
My guest is Patrick Coburn. He's the co-author of the new book, Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. Coburn is senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. Let's take a break here, and then we'll talk some more about Saddam Hussein and how he's managed to stay in power for so long. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Patrick Coburn, co-author of the new book, Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. He's senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. There was an underground opposition group called El Nada. Am I saying that right?
El Nada, yeah.
In English, that means the awakening. Mm. And you write about how they tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein's oldest son, Uday. They managed to shoot him 8 times, but he survived. Why did they choose him, Saddam's oldest son, as the target?
They decided that there were the 4 most important people in the regime were Saddam, his 2 sons, Uday and Tuzai, and a cousin of his, Ali Hassan al-Majid. They then looked at who would be the easiest to attack. Saddam, very difficult because he's always moving around, very heavy security. Hussein, the other son, keeps a low profile. The cousin also. They thought Uday, who's a playboy, flamboyant, would be the easiest to find and the easiest person to get information about. So they decided to target him.
Well, say they had succeeded in killing him, would that have toppled the regime? What impact could that have had?
It would have had an impact, and it did have an impact, the fact they'd shot him. Because despite everything that had happened, the elite of the regime, the inner core, had gave to Iraqis a sense that they were invulnerable. Despite everything that happened, wars, defeats in wars, conspiracies, plots, nobody had ever got to them. So what they wanted to do was to show that the regime was not invulnerable. And they also wanted to show that Iraqis themselves inside the country, not a foreign-directed plot, could do something against the regime. Ordinary Iraqis often have a sense of impotence, political impotence. They feel the whole time they're the victims, but they're watching a battle which affects their lives between Saddam, the regime, and its many enemies outside the country. They wanted to show that ordinary Iraqis could do something, and they succeeded in doing that.
Uday, Saddam's eldest son, seems like a particularly scary figure. You describe him as a playboy who revered Western taste and culture. A few years ago, he murdered one of his father's closest aides.
Yes, he murdered Hannah Jarjo, who's his father's close aide, food taster. It was over a dispute within the family. Saddam had taken a mistress. His wife, Sajida, was very angry, was close to Uday. There was a party in on an island in the center of Baghdad. Uday drinks very heavily. His mother and others were at one party. Uday decided to hold a party next door. He got very drunk and had a quarrel with Jarjo, this close aide of his father, and killed him.
No, Uday Saddam's oldest son also murdered 2 of his brothers-in-law, yes?
Yes, I mean, when Hussein Kamel who was married to one of his sisters, and his brother married to another sister, fled to Jordan. And there's no doubt that they were frightened of Uday. They were competing with him in business. They were scared of him. This was one of the reasons that they fled to Jordan.
I know for a while Uday was the head of Iraqi media. Does he still hold that position?
He's influential, but not quite as he was before. He was very badly wounded. I mean, the bottom half of his body. He was in a car when he was shot. It was somebody leaning forward and downwards, pumping bullets into him at close range. So he's very badly injured. He's not sexually impotent, as a lot of Iraqis believed at the time. But
This was an issue because he was such a playboy.
Yeah, I think people kind of wanted to believe it because they felt that there was a certain sort of justice in the idea that somebody who'd been known for raping women should now that be unable to have no sex life at all. But it's not true.
Did you ever have to deal with him directly since he was the head of Iraqi media?
We met him at one stage and had dinner with him, in which we should say he behaved very well. He speaks good English. And you don't meet him directly because of his control of the media. It's done through other people. He doesn't come out and make statements. You can work out what's in his mind because you know that he will have determined what appears, and he has one paper, for instance, called Babel, his television channels and other things. He would tell the editor what to write. Occasionally, he wouldn't then forget what he'd said to the editor, and the editor would be thrown in prison or lashed. And for aides to Uday, he used to keep tape recorders in their pockets when he gave them any order, as a sort of defense, if afterwards he said, why did you write this or why did you say this? And they'd say, well, you told me to. And then he'd say, well, no, I didn't. So they always had these tape recorders with them to play back what their orders in a desperate, not always very successful attempt to avoid severe punishment.
Is it a funny feeling to be sitting down with someone who's such a tyrant, part of a tyrannical regime, and having a nice civil dinner?
Oh, sure, yes. Because with you don't know how these people are going to react. I mean, they're friendly at one moment, but you know their track record.
Mm-hmm. They know yours. I mean, I'm sure they know how you feel about their regime. They've probably read your stuff.
Well, I was kind of hoping not too closely. And you don't know how much they read. I mean, it's peculiar being a journalist there. I mean, last year I was summoned to the Ministry of Information twice, and I was a bit worried as to what they were going to complain about. But what they focus on most of all is any criticism of Saddam himself. And I'd written a number of things which I thought they really wouldn't like at all about various plots and to have been executed. But in fact, one of the things that irritated them was that I'd written an article comparing Saddam Hussein to Shakespeare's Richard III, who had also had a very bloody career and killed his two nephews and so forth. And they didn't like this at all, this rather, I thought, amusing historical parallel, because this particular king, you may recall, only lasted 3 years. Saddam's lasted 30. But they objected strongly to that. Sometimes it's something very serious, and sometimes it's very trivial. I also kept in mind that the last British journalist to be arrested and jailed there was hanged. So that never leaves your mind either.
So what do you do when they criticize this piece? Are you supposed to apologize or what?
No. I mean, I said, well... I said, look, this is Shakespeare. It's a respectable historical parallel. That's what I wrote. And so, no, I didn't apologize. And and they didn't carry it forward after that.
has a chilling effect?
Oh, yes. And you should be chilled by this. I mean, sometimes people arrive in Baghdad and they feel it's not as bad as it looks, but you always got to be, anybody with any sense is very wary there.
So, listen, getting back to that dinner for a second, I have to ask, who picked up the tab, you or Uday?
I think there was some confusion of the bill afterwards. It's quite difficult to pay with these people. I mean, I think it was on the hotel bill eventually.
Right, that people don't charge you Uday, I guess.
So. Yeah, it's not a big issue at the end of dinners like that. You don't sort of sit there glancing at your watch, wondering where the bill is, and seeing if you've been ever charged or anything.
All right. Patrick Coburn is co-author of Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Pantheon Books, publisher of Anne Lamott's latest book, Traveling Mercies, Some Thoughts on Faith, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion with journalist Patrick Coburn about how Saddam Hussein has managed to remain in power. And we meet soul singer Otis Clay. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, with more of our interview with Patrick Coburn, co-author with his brother Andrew of the new book Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. Patrick Coburn is senior Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. The Allies are continuing to bomb Iraq. Yesterday, U.S. and British warplanes conducted 3 raids. Do you think that we're basically engaged in a low-level war with Iraq now?
Yes, I think that's quite a good way of describing it. I mean, we now have pretty well daily bombings by U.S. and British aircraft of Iraqi positions. We had big bombing in December, but it's all escalating. And there's always a chance that it could escalate very fast. I mean, either a plane gets shot down or a plane crashes for operational reasons, I mean, for just by accident, and then it would escalate once again. So the pot is boiling more and more, and there's always a chance it's going to overboil. And then, to my mind, it's almost inevitable it will overboil.
And then what?
Then we'll see. I mean, one of the problems is that even this low-level war doesn't... It may wound the regime a little, but it doesn't come close to overthrowing it. There was a chance to overthrow it at the end of the Gulf War. George Bush, for not bad reasons, decided that they wouldn't push on to Baghdad. The Gulf War was really a very conservative war to return the Middle East to what it had been before the invasion of Kuwait. He felt he didn't have a mandate. And these were not unreasonable things, but I think it's a mistake to try to get concessions from Iraq that you can only get if you've wholly defeated somebody in a war, which they failed to do. At some point, there should be an agreement which concludes the Gulf War. Sanctions were one way, which described in Washington as keeping Saddam in his box. The problem is that 22 million Iraqis were also in the same box, and they suffered more than Saddam. It was very much a shotgun approach. If there's to be any end to this conflict, other than the whole regime disintegrating or being overthrown, which people have been trying to do for a long time now and hasn't happened, I think it has to be much more focused on, for instance, not overall sanctions against the country, but very tight restrictions on weapons or the materials to make weapons being brought into the country, inspection of existing facilities in there. That would really limit the offensive capability of the regime. Otherwise, the real casualties of all this are ordinary Iraqis.
You were in Iraq during the December bombing. Where did you stay?
I stayed in the Al-Rashid Hotel, which is the big hotel which is normally used by journalists there. It has a number of advantages, one of which it has its own big generators. So it seemed possible during the bombing that they'd hit the power stations or the power lines as they did in 91. If you're staying in a place which is dependent on general power, then suddenly the elevators don't work, the lights go out, you can't work. So there aren't too many places where you guarantee that the building is probably going to go on functioning.
It must be so surreal when you're at the Al-Rashid Hotel to know that, you know, the missiles are coming into the city. The anti-aircraft fire is exploding in the air. And there's like a press conference going on the roof. Oh, you know, all the cameras are on the roof shooting it. You know, it's being televised live around the world on CNN. It's so bizarre.
It is bizarre, and it's almost a new type of warfare, which is sort of deceptive because you see on camera, and night vision equipment often even exaggerates the amount of light because it... that is coming from the anti-aircraft going up, that you see these great explosions, and it often exaggerates the extent of the bombardment. It did this in 91 as well, because people don't realize that Baghdad is a very big city. It's a very flat city. It extends a long way. So it looks as though this is a total destruction of the city. It isn't. I mean, it's quite heavy. But it gives a slightly deceptive feel to how badly the Iraqi government or Iraqis in general are being hit.
Where did you position yourself during the bombing in December?
I was around town. The bombing took place at night. The Iraqis had very tight security. You could see at crossroads... Army, Mukhabarat, that's secret police, Ba'ath Party, the ruling party, were with the submachine guns. You see the little Yugoslav submachine guns and Kalashnikovs, civil police at all the intersections. The whole town closed down, so there were very few people on the streets. What they liked you to do was to be on the Ministry of Information roof where the television cameras were, but you could also see it from the hotel or wherever you were. Some places you could go to afterwards, which had been hit, or you could see it from the road. Some places that they kept you well back.
So did you stay on the roof, stay in your room?
I did both. I mean, I on the roof of the, on top of, I mean, on the upper stories of the hotel, on the roof. I also sort of drove around a bit.
At night?
Yeah.
You felt safe doing that?
No. I'm not safe for two reasons. One, you think the chances, the percentage chances of being hit are pretty small, but when you're driving around, you sort of, somehow, you don't feel that safe. The other thing is, what always happens with bombing, I've seen in other places that are being shelled, is that anybody who's driving on the streets starts driving like crazy. They don't obviously stop at traffic lights. They don't stop at intersections. So actually, in reality, there's probably a greater chance of being hit by another car.
What about all the armed guards?
There are the armed guards there. I mean, I always try to get I had a driver to drive slowly for two reasons. One, that I could see some other cars were rocketing around. And if they hit you, this is going to be really serious. Secondly, if you don't see guards at an intersection and you're driving fast, you could drive straight through them just by accident. And again, that'd be very dangerous because they might open fire.
Right. Do you think of Saddam Hussein as being brilliant in his paranoia?
Yeah, that's well put. There is a brilliance there. He's extraordinarily clever at, in terms of Iraqi politics, internal politics, of balancing the different factions, of creating multiple loyalties, by which I mean somebody might be loyal to him for tribal reasons, or because they're a member of the party, or because they've received money, or they're part of his family, to prevent anybody uniting behind him. And this is what makes it so difficult to deal with Iraq or predict policy, that at various moments he seems extraordinarily subtle and cunning, but with a great capacity to overplay his hand when things are going well for him. I think partly was nobody around him really dares ever contradict him. I mean, I remember one Russian diplomat in Baghdad who'd had a lot of dealings with the leadership, and I said, well, you know, what about the sort of the more so-called more liberal members of the elite, like Tariq Aziz, who's, who you often is often acts as the spokesman. And he said, well, look, the only safe thing to do if you're meeting with Saddam and you're part of his entourage is to be 10% tougher than the boss. You kind of work out what they say, what they do would be work out in their mind what the boss's policy was, what Saddam's policy was, and then sort of reiterate that with 10% more. So he's not a man who necessarily gets good advice. He also is somebody who doesn't know the outside world, so his grossest errors were attacking Iran in 1980 and attacking Kuwait in 1990. And the two decisions have a lot in parallel, that he had a sense that he was in a strong position, but he exaggerated the strength, and both brought disaster.
Well, Patrick Coburn, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
No, thank you. Enjoy it.
Patrick Coburn is the co-author of Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. Our interview was recorded Thursday during his visit to the U.S. Coming up, soul singer Otis Clay. This is Fresh Air. The Memphis-based soul label, High Records, was famous for its recordings by Al Green, Syl Johnson, O.V. Wright, Ann Peebles, and my guest, Otis Clay. Clay recorded with High from 1968 to 74. His most popular High recording was Trying to Live My Life Without You. The song was later recorded by Bob Seger. Clay's latest CD, This Time Around, reunites him with High record producer Willie Mitchell and members of the High Rhythm Section, including drummer Howard Grimes. Clay grew up in Mississippi and has spent most of his adult life in Chicago. He got his start singing gospel music. Before we meet him, let's hear a track from his latest CD, This Time Around.
Slap some sense in me. Open my eyes, 'cause I'm too blind to see. I've got this woman, and she's messing my mind around. She knows that I love her, but still she's trying to put me down.
Otis Clay, your new CD reunites you with some of the people you used to work with in Memphis back in your High record days, High as in High Records. What does being with this group bring out in you, do you think?
Well, we are so compatible musically, and we worked together over the years for so long. We work very well together. We genuinely love each other. And it just, and we're all from, although I live in Chicago, I'm from that area down there. So just a bunch of homeboys together there and really enjoying the music.
I'd like to hear a little bit about your early days. Would you describe for us where you grew up in Waxhaw in the Mississippi Delta?
Waxhaw's a junction. You know, there's nothing there anymore. It was a general store. And we were farmers. My family, I came from a big family, 10 of us, and I'm the youngest of 10. So it was, you know, church on Sunday, of course, and sometime during the week, and a lot of singing in the family because in my family, being in the church and everything, you had musicians and choir members, and my grandfather was a minister. So you had a lot, all these kind of things happening around the house all the time.
And what did your family farm?
Cotton, corn, soybeans, things like that.
Did you work in the fields?
Yeah. Didn't like it, but I did.
Did the family had to. Did the family sing in the fields? And if so, what were the songs that you liked to sing then?
Oh yeah, yeah. That was a lot of things. We didn't. The thing that's about that is, during that time, we had to sing spirituals. We weren't allowed to sing secular music, although I was very familiar with it. I was hearing a lot of it, but we weren't allowed to sing it, especially if our parent was around. We could do it when we were, you know, when we were by ourselves. You know, we could sing all the things that we wanted to, but the parents didn't allow us to sing anything other than gospel music.
So here you are growing up in the Mississippi Delta, which is one of the most important places for the blues, and you're not supposed to be listening to or singing secular music. Did the blues seem to be dangerous to you, to live up to its reputation as the devil's music?
Well, that's what it was. It was, you know, it was the devil's music. You know, I mean, you sing the blues, you're going to go to hell. You know, plus you probably get a whooping along with it.
Right, more immediately.
Yeah.
Did you have a way of hearing the blues?
Well, yeah. You know, we were listening to WLAC at night and out of Nashville. And you could get all these grand sales that they would have coming out of Ernie's Record Mart and all those places where you could get five songs for, oh, I forget what the price was, but it was very, you know, nothing like today. You know, you get this package deal, you know, this soul special and this gospel special, you know. And we would mail order a lot of that stuff out of Nashville from Ernie Records, yeah.
What if your parents saw it when it came in the mail?
Well, the parents, they knew very well all the things that was happening there, you know. But again, we weren't allowed to listen, weren't allowed to sing blues or secular music, period.
You mean you were allowed to listen but not to sing?
Yeah, we could listen, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because my family... You heard of the old Saturday Night Fish Fry. Well, although my mother, well, you have to understand, first of all, my mother was very religious, and my father was a gambler. Now, put that together and see what you come up with. But that's the way it was. And most of the time on weekends and things like that, you know, they would have, well, there was quite a bit of bootleg, you know, moonshining going on, too. And at night, on these weekends, they would have this fish fry, and they would have chitlins and all these things, and they would sell, and a lot of people would come around. And that's how you heard the children, you know, we would be at all these gatherings, and we would hear what the grown folks were doing, but we weren't allowed to do it.
Would your father go to church on Sundays and repent on Sunday for the gambling he did during the week?
No. No. He was, most of the time, he was recovering from the night before. No, well, you know, but, yeah, occasionally, you know, he would, just occasionally, but that's so rare, you know. It was acceptable. It was a known fact that was somewhat to, you know, how the male, you know, they were always doing some things that they should have been repenting for, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is soul singer Otis Clay. Now, you toured with several different gospel groups in the 50s and in the 60s. I have one example here of your gospel singing, and it's wonderful, so I thought I would play it. And it's with the Gospel Songbirds. This was recorded in 1963.
Oh, wow.
And the song is If I Could Hear My Mother. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this group, the Gospel Songbirds.
The sad part is, you know, with that CD, most of them have passed on now. And it really saddens me when I listen to that, because we had a great time together. You know, these groups are like family, brothers, you know what I mean, extension of the family. And we really, truly loved each other. And I was with that group for quite a few years. That was the last local group that I sang with before I went with the Sensational Nightingales, the Gospel Songbirds. We were quite a group. If you can, when you listen, I have that CD, and when I listen to it, I say, hey, we were pretty good.
Yes. I agree. So let's hear it. This is you singing lead, If I Could Hear My Mother.
I believe I'll testify, Lord help me, while I have a chance. The reason why I like to leave my testimony with you, I may not ever see you, but before I go, I like to sing my favorite song, and it goes something like this. How sweet and Lord, say, of which I Lord help me, I can hear the memory calling every now and then. Oh, and when a rapture was sweet, Lord, my weary heart would be, if only I, Lord, help me.
That was Otis Clay singing lead, recorded, I believe, in about 1963, The Gospel Songbirds. Otis Clay is now best known as a soul singer. You're living in Chicago and have lived there for many years. How did you get from Mississippi to Chicago? Why did you decide to move?
I really didn't. It was a family thing. And I always say Chicago is a suburb of Mississippi. Everybody leave Mississippi and come to Chicago. And that was that great migration that was during that time. But my family didn't really move to Chicago when we first left the South. We moved to a little town or city in Indiana called Muncie, Indiana. I lived there, and I was very young. My mother died while we lived there, and I came and stayed in Chicago briefly with an uncle. And my maternal grandfather also lived here. And I didn't stay long. I went back to Mississippi, and I lived with an older sister of mine for about a year and a half or so. And then I came back to Chicago to live with my uncle, and that was about 1956.
What was it like for you to live in the big city after growing up in, you know, a small rural part of the Mississippi Delta?
was exciting, of course. But again, you were always close to friends that you knew from the South, you know, so that kept it, you know, that made it a bit more comfortable. You know, you needed that type of thing when you're in the big city, you know, to be in a big city, a stranger and no friends. I mean, I would think that would be unbearable.
My guest is soul singer Otis Clay. His latest CD is called This Time Around. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is soul singer Otis Clay. His latest CD is called This Time Around. How did your life change when you started singing soul music and moved away from gospel?
Well, I never really quite moved away from gospel because I have a gospel album right now that's been around for quite some time, and it's a very popular album.
So you're doing both?
Yeah, I still do a lot of gospel concerts. Get with all my old friends that's still in the gospel field, and we tour sometime. And so it really didn't change an awful lot because I still have the same friends, and we get together as much as possible.
Now, I believe when you first started to record secular music, you cut a few singles for Columbia Records, but those singles weren't released. And when they weren't released, my understanding is that you hid them from your friends who sang gospel music because you didn't want them to know. Why not?
Well, we come back to that decision again. You know, I had my little popularity as a gospel singer, you know, and you had enough people talking. So that was one time I didn't brag about it, you know. And I'm really glad that I didn't because it was never released. And that would have really gave them something to talk about, you know. I just kept it a secret.
Would they have been angry at you or feel that you couldn't sing with them anymore if they knew about those records?
Oh, of course. You know, they at that time, it wouldn't have been acceptable. You know, now people are a bit more broad-minded, but at that time, no, I wouldn't have been able to remain in the group. If especially once they had released the secular.
What do you think is your greatest record? Do you have any?
Oh, well, you know, we were talking about that. Someone asked me that question, and that was a record that I recorded, and I've recorded it several times. It was called If I Could Reach Out and Help Somebody. I recorded it first for High in 1973, and then I recorded it on the first Live Japan album. And then it's also on the gospel album, too. So there's about three versions of it out there.
Why don't we hear the first version of it, the High Records version of it? And before we play it, I'd like to know what it is about this song that gets you to single it out as being the best.
Well, the song, the spiritual side of it, the charitable side of it, and I genuinely feel that way. You always want to make a difference in this world. If there's something that you can do, something you can help someone along the way, we try to do as much charity as possible, you know, because we realize that we're blessed. And we like to pass that on. I think that's our duty. We are our brother's keeper.
Okay, well, this is If I Could Reach Out, sung by Otis Clay from the 70s.
Reach out. somebody, then I've had a good day. If I could help some sister or brother,
that's Otis Clay, recorded in the mid-70s, back in his days with the High record label. And he's reunited with some of those people from High Records on his new CD, this time around. You grew up singing with your family. You have, I think, eight children of your own.
Yes.
Did you all sing together when the kids were young?
Well, they sing in church. They pretty much took, they've taken pretty much the same road that I took. Although none of them are singing professionally.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter, Hope, she decided one New Year's Eve that she was going to sing with me, and she said, I want to sing. I said, okay. That was her debut, and that was the last time she walked on stage. But everybody is in church, pretty much the same thing.
Otis Clay, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Otis Clay's latest CD, This Time Around, is on the label Bullseye Blues and Jazz. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth. I'm Terry Gross.
There's too many people telling too many lies. My friend is gonna build me a city in the sky where I can fly away to that city so high. I won't have to worry. Now I sure ain't gonna miss the city I left behind. Day after day, it just blows.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Pantheon Books, publisher of Anne Lamott's latest book, Traveling Mercies, Some Thoughts on Faith, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the director and co-writer of the new film, Rushmore, Wes Anderson. And crime novelist Elmore Leonard tells us about his new book, Be Cool. It's a sequel to Get Shorty. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.